Board Game Bros.
Hello, welcome to Board Game Bros. I'm Matt Craig.
And I'm Jeff Craig. We are board game designers in real life, and we're brothers in real life, and this is our podcast where we talk about board game design.
This is episode 5 of our podcast, and also episode 5 of our Gateway Games series on this podcast, in which we discuss some popular gateway games.
Yes, Matthew, I'm confused on this term you keep using, gateway game. What is a gateway game?
A gateway game is an introduction into the world of board gaming for new players. Also, it's still a very, very interesting, very in-depth, and approachable for veterans alike.
So you're saying that a gateway game, much like how St. Louis is the gateway to Western drugs, board games are gateways to Western board games. And
Eastern board games. Pretty much every board game.
All right.
Today, we're talking about Forbidden Island.
Ooh, Forbidden Island. Now, I had never played this until tonight. I just got finished with my very first playthrough through the game.
So, all your thoughts are still fresh in your head.
Yes, I have. I'm in the honeymoon phase with Forbidden Island. So,
It's interesting. I want to bring up first that this will be the first time on our show that we're covering a cooperative game.
Yep. Well, yeah, and that's sort of why we've included Forbidden Island in this list of gateway games, is because this is the gateway cooperative game.
Pretty much,
in my opinion, after having played maybe 3 or 4 cooperative games.
Definitely, yeah.
Others, maybe even others considered gateway games. This is the most gateway-weighted sounds great.
Anyways,
so Matthew, you've played this before. You know a little bit about this game. Tell me about Forbidden Island.
Yeah. So Forbidden Island was designed by Matt Laycock, released in 2010 originally. It was nominated for the Spiel des Jahres, but did not win, sadly. However, it did win the Golden Geek Children's Game of the Year Award on Board Game Geek, which is a well-known and popular website for board game enthusiasts. It had a sequel as well, which was Forbidden Desert, released in 2013. However, as I said today, we're talking about the original Forbidden Island.
Okay. Who published Forbidden Island?
It is Game Right Games.
Game Right Games. Okay. Very cool. And what year was it published again?
2010.
2010. All right. So, Forbidden Island. So, to play the game... the goal of the game is that there are these 4 artifacts that have been stashed away on this secret hidden island in the middle of the sea, and your team has to go collect these 4 artifacts before the island sinks. So to set up the game, there are 24 of these square island tiles. You arrange them in a circle, all face up, and then you take the cards in the game and you separate them into 2 decks. There's a deck of flood cards and a deck of item cards. You immediately reveal the first top 6 flood cards, and all of those cards get flipped face down. Those are island tiles that are getting flipped face down. They get flipped to their flooded side, which has grayed out artwork. Then every player gets 1 of 6 roles, and these 6 roles are navigator, diver, pilot, engineer, explorer, or messenger. And each one has special abilities that affect how they play the game. And then everybody gets 2 item cards. And then the first person, or the last person to have visited an island, gets to go first. On a player's turn, they have 3 actions, which they can spend to do any of 4 different actions. Any number of 4 different actions. And those 4 actions are, they can move 1 space to an adjacent island tile. They can shore up the island tile they're on, or an adjacent island tile. They can give a treasure card to another player as long as they're standing on the same tile as them. Or they can capture one of the 4 major artifacts by discarding matching sets of 4 item cards that match the kind of treasure that you're trying to collect from your hand. After you perform your 3 actions on your turn, you draw 2 treasure cards. And then after that, there is a special tracker that sits beside the board game that tracks, it's the flood counter. And whatever number the flood counter is set at, that's how many more flood cards you draw, and that's how many more island tiles get flipped over. If you ever draw a flood card for an island tile that's already flipped to its flooded side, then that tile is removed from the board. So as you play the game, the island starts to shrink and it gets kind of claustrophobic. In addition, each special artifact can only be obtained from two specific island tiles. So if both island tiles of any particular artifact are removed from the board, everybody loses. Now, the way that island tiles or flood cards would be drawn for a second time is that mixed inside the item deck, there are three cards called Waters Rise. And each time one of the Waters Rise cards is drawn, you slide that flood counter up to the next tick, which might increase the number of flood cards that you draw each turn. And then you take all the flood cards that you've drawn up to that point and you shuffle them and put them back on top of the deck. And so that's how tiles will get drawn more than once in a game, and that makes the tiles that are already flooded more likely to be ones that are going to sink permanently for the rest of the game. Now, also in those item cards are special actions. There is the Chopper Lift special action, which can be played at any point in the game to move any player to any tile. And then there's the Sandbag special action, which can be played at any point in the game to shore up any tile, any island tile, except you can't use that right after you draw that island tile and it would be lost forever, just sinking into the sea. So I mentioned the rolls before, just to go over a little bit. Each roll has a different starting point on the island. They start on a specific island tile. And each role has special abilities that modify the way they play the game and how they use their actions. So just to go over them, the diver can move through adjacent flood or missing tiles for one action. So they can sort of pass through them to the other side rather than having to walk across them. And they don't mind gaps in the map that occur later in the game once many of the island tiles have been sunk. The pilot can once per turn use an action to fly anywhere on the island. The engineer can shore up two tiles for one action rather than just shoring up one tile. The explorer can move and or shore up diagonally. And then the messenger can trade treasure to any player anywhere on the map for one action. So that's the basics of how to play. Now, it being a cooperative game, there's a win condition that I mentioned, which is you collect all the four treasures and you leave the island from the helicopter pad. But there are multiple losing conditions. I've already mentioned one, and that's if two island tiles that would grant you the same artifact both sink into the sea. The other three ways of losing the game is if the Fool's Landing tile sinks. So if the helicopter pad disappears into the sea, that's end of the game. If any player on an island tile that sinks, and there's no adjacent tile to swim to, then the game ends, which means whenever an island tile sinks into the sea, if there is a player on it, they have the chance to swim to a nearby tile. But if that tile that they were on is stranded, game's over. Although, if you are certain roles, you have the option. For instance, the pilot can never lose the game this way, because it allows them to fly to any other tile when this happens to them. Finally, the last way to lose the game is if the water level reaches the skull and crossbones. So on the flood counter tracker, at the very top, there's skull and crossbones. So if you draw too many Waters Rise cards, then the game will end.
Yeah.
And that's the basics of how to play Forbidden Island.
Pretty much.
So let's talk about the game design.
Well, so as we've been doing with our Gateway game series, what makes Forbidden Island such a good gateway cooperative game?
Okay. Well, first of all, I think what surprised me was that in a lot of these types of games where you have a map that you have to explore that's all put together, and similar games, the tiles, when they're flipped over, they're invisible to you. You don't know where to go. But in this game, you can clearly see where everything is on the map at all times, which is nice. We know that having more open information in a game is helpful.
And also, with it being a cooperative game, since every player is encouraged to have their hand of cards face up so that you can see what all your teammates have in their hands as far as items go.
It's actually in the rules. It says, really? Once you're dealt your hand, flip it face up.
Yeah, so the game actually helps a lot with that also because any item is a specific color. Mm-hmm. There's a yellow one, a red one, a blue one, and a purplish black one. So you can easily look across the table and see how many of each type of item each of your teammates has.
Mm-hmm. I'd say that this is the thing that makes this the most gateway-iest of these cooperative games is that it is a very reduced game.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's loads of opportunities for the designers of this game to add more pieces and more complexity, but the game that they ended up with that I played today is just the least amount of pieces necessary to play a game like this.
It's extremely compact and concise.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, there's the four items that you have to collect, the four artifacts. Mm-hmm. In the item deck, you either draw one of those four, or you draw one of those two special actions, or you draw the Water's Rise.
Mm-hmm.
That's it for items. There's nothing else beyond that, nothing other, any crazy complex actions. The six rolls have all very simple things that really only affect one aspect of their gameplay. So there's nothing to really juggle there.
Yeah.
They don't really, I would say, add extra decisions to your
gameplay. Yeah, they don't radically change the way the character or player plays.
Right.
But they're still different enough that it sort of, it gives an identity to the player.
Right. I'd say, yeah, because in these kinds of games, when you have an action economy like this where you are given a set number of actions that you can use to do a variety of things,
mm-hmm.
that can be very complicated.
Yeah.
Tracking which actions you've used in a turn, over a turn, and then deciding what the correct order is mm-hmm. in a turn is kind of hard. And in most of the games like this, they give you all of these actions right from the get-go.
Yeah.
So you just have to, for a new player, analyze what each action does. And so that the actions are each very different from one another and each very obvious when you need to do them and how you need to do them.
Yeah.
And that each roll doesn't really change each action all that much to make the decision any more complicated. Mm-hmm. That definitely helps for being a gateway game.
And that the order you do your turn in, it doesn't take a lot of sort of fandangling with the rules and everything to figure out what the best order is.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually pretty obvious since the board's pretty small and it's easy to move around. And since the flooded tiles are a different color completely, it's very easy to see here's the flooded tiles near you.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and they also put really big giant icons in the corners of the tiles that provide you with those special artifacts.
And the Fool's Landing has a big red stripe on it.
Right, right. So they make it abundantly clear which of the islands are most important for you to keep alive at the beginning of the game. Mm-hmm. And even when you flip it over to the backside of the islands that are the island tiles that have the artifacts on them, the artifact is still in color.
Mm-hmm.
So that still helps you recognize, you know, oh, I can see it's flooded now.
Yeah.
But I can see that's one of those important tiles. We got to flip it back over as soon as we can. Now I noticed, in this game, even though it's easy to figure out what the actions are supposed to be, and you don't have to do very much talking back and forth between other players to mm-hmm. get the most efficient path to victory. There is certainly opportunity for it that, mm-hmm. that I encountered just in this very first playthrough of the game.
And another thing that is pretty interesting is this game outright has difficulty settings.
Yeah.
So the flood counter, it has its lowest number of cards you would draw is 2, and then the highest before you would lose the game is 5.
Right.
And there are difficulty settings, I believe, between 2, 3, and 4, going anywhere from beginner to elite.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're encouraged to start at that novice level for any given time. But if you want a more challenging game, it's available for you. It's just increased the number.
Right.
And it's also pretty nice because it goes back to making a concise game. There's not any extra rules added to the game when you start at a higher difficulty.
Right, that's a good point. It's just
increase the number.
Sure, a lot of games like to have, like, like bonus packs or
cards you remove from a deck
or more complex cards that you can add later.
Yeah.
Those will increase the difficulty or just the variety. But this game, you know, if you want a difficulty, it's a very elegant way of saying of knowing what's difficult in the game and knowing how just a slight modification like that could change it. Now, one thing that you mentioned is that it's replayable, and that's important in a gateway game, because the point of a gateway game, one of the points of the gateway game is that you start to understand that these strategy board games have these deep strategies, and the only way that you can really find out what strategies there are available to you in a game as a new player is to play it more than once.
Yeah.
And so having just that built-in replayability, even just like the idea, the notion that, you know, why don't you try playing it again? If you thought it was so easy the first time, you know, you might be surprised.
Yeah.
You know, it encourages somebody to play it again and to, delve even deeper into what goes into, surviving this game.
Yeah. So another thing I want to mention about being a gateway game is the order that things happen in a turn. So the structure of a turn. It's very simple. There's three parts to a turn. It's do your actions, draw item cards, and then draw flood cards. And I think in some games, having a lot of different steps to a turn can not only be intimidating for new players, but if it's a lot of new players, they can forget, and then the game ends up being wrong, sort of, like you play it the wrong way. So it's good to have just very simple order to everything.
Now, I did a little bit of looking around after playing this one playthrough, and there's a big community of people that like to share how they've modified the game. That's kind of interesting too, in that since this is almost kind of like a bare bones game, there's plenty of room to add things. Like I mentioned, the designers probably thought of a million things they could have added to this game, but they didn't. But now you can, which is kind of interesting for a gateway game. These kinds of opportunities might not be so apparent in other games, but in this game, you know, It's just a blank island with a couple of guys on it looking for four artifacts.
Yeah.
And anything else you could add to that game could make it just that much more exciting and interesting for you.
Yeah.
Starting out, you don't have to arrange the tiles in a circle. You can arrange them in any shape you want, which could, if it's more of like a long map and you end up with some of the artifacts on the ends, that automatically increases some difficulty and makes you make different decisions. But beyond that, there's tons of other things you could do. And I encourage anybody that's played this game to look into it. Try and find... I saw one document online on Board Game Geek that added monkeys, dinosaurs, typhoons, and cannibals into the game. All in one document.
Sounds exciting.
So, look into that.
Yeah.
I'm excited to try that out.
Yeah, I... Honestly, the thought never occurred to me to actually customize really any game that I've played, except for when I was younger. I know there are some games that come with extra blank cards.
Like we talked about them. Dominion
comes
with blank cards, and we've come up with a couple of dumb Dominion cards that we've added to the game never use because they're dumb and broken in most cases. But
I would definitely encourage anybody to do that, though, because not only is it add replayability to the game, but it also does get you thinking like a game designer.
And thinking like a game designer is the first step
to being
like a game designer.
Yeah.
Sure. Which is kind of cool.
So something I want to talk about for a bit is actually sort of these sort of underlying game mechanics and rules that are in several cooperative games. Since we haven't talked about one yet, and this is the only one we'll talk for out of this series.
Right. So and of course, gateway games are gateways into more games in the same genre. So this being a gateway into cooperative games, what are some of the things you can expect from other games after playing Forbidden Island?
So I do want to mention the designer of this, Matt Leacock, also designed another very good and pretty gateway-friendly board game that's cooperative called Pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've played Pandemic, and I would definitely consider this one to be slightly more gateway, just because the very first game of Pandemic I ever played, I lost very handily.
So that's what I want to get to first, is... So the difference, obviously, between cooperative and competitive games is, in competitive, like, there's always going to be a winner and a loser.
Mm-hmm.
Or a draw, but that's an outlier case. In cooperative games, if everybody is working together, there's no, like, traitor or dungeon master or anything,
mm-hmm.
then you have, or as a designer, you would have to work in ways to either win or lose. And I think... In general, people enjoy winning.
Mm-hmm.
So as a game designer, you kind of want to have like a good chance of winning and a good chance of losing. But as a player, it would be boring if you knew you could win every game you play without even trying.
Right.
I think Forbidden Island, for me, I've only played it on the easier difficulties. So it's usually been kind of easy in that regard. But then again, I haven't tried the harder difficulties, which we said is one of the cool things about this game.
Sure.
But I think that pretty much every cooperative game has that sort of, like, you can increase the difficulty in some way, you know, to make it harder or easier. There's other cooperative games that obviously don't do that. Like, Pandemic is actually kind of rigid,
mm-hmm.
but that is something I think this goes better. But another thing I wanted to bring up is that a lot of cooperative games for their losing state use a timer that I've noticed. That's a common thing in a lot of these games.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of it being that you have to avoid specific actions to lose, it's more like you have to think in terms of like that action economy, efficiency minded mindset.
Right.
To win, because you have so much time to do so.
Right. So in Forbidden Island, it has that in the form of the flood counter.
And the waters rise.
And the waters rise.
Because it could make a important tile sink.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought up Pandemic. In Pandemic, there's certain rates of cities getting infected and outbreaking. Or I think if you just run out of cards, you lose anyways. So.
Mm-hmm.
Usually that is sort of good, because I think if the game didn't have a way to encourage, you know, that sort of thinking hard about what you're doing and how to win quickly, it might not come off as a game that has more depth at the start to some players.
Mm-hmm.
I think throwing players in with a definite timer in front of them sort of already says that you should be thinking about these things.
Mm-hmm. I'd say it's like it puts it. The fact that you might lose right in front of you, so instead of it just being losing being just entirely based on luck, which it's still a little bit based on luck, but now you have time to plan and to mitigate the luck that is you drawing too many of these waters rising cards too quickly.
And another thing that I've seen so many different cooperative games do is the different roles.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it makes it so that so every player sort of has a different purpose in mind. Even if you're cooperating with everybody and talking a lot and, you know, just directing everybody to perfectly win the game, it's like nobody feels replaceable by any other player.
Right.
You can't really interchange players because somebody might have a specific action that's handy for something. And I think that's cool, because ultimately in a cooperative game, I think players want to feel part of the team, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
So having that purpose that says you are the only one that can do this is a cool design idea. And it allows for replayability if there's more roles or characters than there are players possible in a game.
Or, I mean, you could always just shuffle around roles, too.
You can just combine and shuffle roles.
That's a good point. That 'cause sometimes when you play these cooperative games, if there's one person that's really into it, it can feel like they're just kind of playing everybody else's character. But usually, since your character does something that nobody else's character does, and mm-hmm. you spend the most time thinking about your moves on your turn, then you're bringing something new to the table for every turn and for every game. One thing I think that's also very important in cooperative games that this game does really well is that as the game progresses, it gets harder.
Yeah.
So in this game, it does that by having the flood counter start at a low number. In easy and normal mode, it starts at 2, and in higher modes, it starts at 3 and 4. And then as you play the game, it goes up. So first, every turn, two islands are sinking, which is pretty easy to bring back up two islands on any player's turn. But then when it starts to get to 3 and 4, you have to start making choices and abandoning things, and eventually, I'm sure it can get very out of hand. To the point where there's just no saving everything, and you have to make some pretty big sacrifices. Every cooperative game, as far as I know, has that aspect to it.
Which
is good, because when you start a game, you know, for the very first time, it's important that it starts out slow. It's like a video game. It starts out slow. It slowly introduces you to the various aspects of the game.
Get used to what you're doing and what other people are doing.
Right. You develop some early strategies, and then it gets harder and harder, and it tests your ability to keep up with the game, and use your actions given to you in creative and economic ways. So that you can beat the game on time.
I know one example that isn't Forbidden Island or Pandemic that comes to mind really quickly is in the game Dead of Winter, which is a cooperative zombie survival game. You both get more survivors to feed over time. And there's also the fact that your characters have a set amount of health. And as you're going around scavenging for supplies, zombies will attack you. And the less health you have, the more difficult it will be to take risks and think about going out in the wasteland or the wilderness to try to get any items you might need at the end. So it adds that sort of same risk-taking, you know, do I really want to try to go for it, making sacrifices mindset? But instead of a number going up, it's a number going down.
What's that Marvel game?
Legendary?
Legendary, right. Yeah. In that game, you're faced up against a classic Marvel supervillain, and as the game progresses, you sort of defeat them in stages.
Yeah.
Is that right? Am I remembering this right?
Sort of, yeah.
And after you defeat them at every stage, the difficulty ramps up in the game, and it starts to get harder to defeat them.
And Sentinels of the Multiverse, I think, oftentimes just adds new cards. So, like, you'll have a boss where you fight it in different forms. You know, the first form's the easy form. Then when you beat that, it flips over and it becomes the super hard form.
So we've mentioned a lot of cooperative games that Forbidden Island could lead you to play. So we've mentioned Pandemic, which is, again, designed by the same guy. So definitely if you play Forbidden Island and you very much enjoy it, there's more of that from Pandemic. And Pandemic has so many different offshoots. And Forbidden Island has a couple different versions. It has Forbidden Desert. So just staying in the very same family, there's plenty of places to go with more interesting things to do. There's also Pandemic Legacy, which we've been playing through. We haven't finished it yet. We're about halfway through the game.
Which, for clarification, Legacy games, and Pandemic Legacy being the Hallmark Legacy game, are more like campaigns that you play sessions through over time. And so what that's saying is we haven't finished the campaign, but we've played through multiple sittings of the game.
And in legacy games, often after you play each game, you will make permanent adjustments to the game. Like you write in Sharpie on cards and tear cards up and put stickers on things.
And new rules are added. There's a storyline and plot developments change the way the game's played, and even your decisions in a round can affect future games, with Pandemic Legacy having outbreaks and diseases that cause people to start going crazy in different cities.
So, but Legacy games, that's a whole other podcast episode. What other, can we think of any other, so we mentioned Dead of Winter. That is a cooperative zombie survival game. Although there are ways to win that game. It's cooperative, but there are hidden objectives that allow you to technically win the game over your
other... there are traitor objectives.
Right.
Though those will not be in every game.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of, you never know who's going to be a traitor, so you can't not trust everybody.
It helps to bring the sort of tension of hiding out in a zombie apocalypse area, mm-hmm. and whether or not you can trust the people that you're working with.
On the other hand, there is Betrayal at the House on the Hill.
Which or guarantees.
If you're a Dungeons & Dragons fan, they release Betrayal at Baldur's Gate.
Yeah, and that guarantees... It starts as a cooperative game where everyone's trying to explore the same mansion, and you're trying to share items with each other, and if somebody gets hurt, you help them out. But then in that game, you collect these items that are omens, that the more you collect, the more likely you are to reveal that one of the players is a traitor. And even when you start the game, nobody knows who the traitor is going to be, so there's no reason to distrust anybody until it happens.
Yeah.
And then when it does, things go crazy. And then
Sentinels of the Multiverse, right? Which is a superhero game in which each player plays as a superhero working to take down a villain.
Mm-hmm. And you get your own deck of cards with your superhero's abilities that you draw and play. There's that Marvel game.
Legendary,
right?
Which is a deck building game in which your deck consists of cards relating to specific heroes,
mm-hmm.
from the Marvel universe. If you're playing Marvel Legendary, and you try to defeat an archvillain as well as several smaller villains,
and each archvillain has a special, unique scheme that they're trying to pull on the city. Those are all really great cooperative games that you can check out if you really like Forbidden Island. So that's going to do it for our fifth episode on Gateway Games, Forbidden Island, the cooperative game. By this time, we do have our own dedicated social media account. So look for that. we're recording these in advance, so we don't have a name for that, but we can go ahead and just tack on it. We could probably just cut this part.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll just cut this part and put in our actual information at that point. All right.
But yeah.
We'll just cut this anyways. We'll say thanks for listening at that point.
Hi, thank you for listening to episode 5 of our Gateway Games series. As always, you can listen to us and provide feedback to us on the Apple Podcasts app, on Stitcher, Google Play, or hopefully wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as on our website at bgbcast.com or on our partner podcast's website at entertainthegeeky.com. You can also find on entertainthegeeky.com Jeffrey's one-page horror-themed role-playing game, Merle's Truck Stop in Maine. It's on sale now for just $1 as well. You can like us on Facebook at BG Bros Cast and follow us on Twitter at BG Bros Cast. You can also message us and provide us feedback on our social media pages. We've already recorded our first 7 episodes, but we are still looking for ways we can improve going forward, and we'd love any input you have. Next week, we'll be discussing Splendor, so make sure to listen then.